The following workshop was recorded at the 7th Annual Pittsburgh Classical Christian Education Conference. For more information about the conference, visit the Blackburn Study Center website at www.blackburnstudycenter.org.
Everybody enjoy lunch? Good, good. Well, this afternoon we're going to be talking about grammar stage teaching methods, and grammar school is what I love. I've had to kind of grow into the dialectic and rhetoric as our children have gotten older, but when it comes to teaching, I am real happy with the munchkins. One of the reasons that I enjoy it so much is just because of how children learn. You know, the way they soak things up, and so it makes it a fun time. Now, I have one question. How many of you all are homeschooling? Okay, so the majority. And how many classroom teachers are in here? Oh, there's quite a few of them. All right. Well, one of the things that happens at our household, because I have a husband who loves numbers and I have a couple of children that loves numbers, is people start calculating things. And one day, I believe it was my husband who made the comment, as either he was teaching to some of the teachers at the school, or I was getting ready to, that teachers typically spend 1,080 hours in a school year with a child. That, when I heard that number, that was unbelievable to me. And whether you're homeschooling and spending that amount of hours teaching your child, or you're a classroom teacher, it's hard to fathom, when I think about it, that that is the amount of time that we spend on education in a year. And when we look at it that way, we ought to be able to get a lot done. I mean, that's a lot of time, 1,080 hours. And so we ought to really be able to accomplish a whole lot. We spend more time with our children as a teacher or as a parent than they spend with their peers, than they spend with anybody else. And so we're going to have the largest influence on their lives. If you're their teacher, second to their parents, you're going to spend the most time with them. And that's an awesome responsibility. And so it's really important, as we think about whether it's our own child or somebody else's, how much our attitude matters. Our children pick up so much at, you know, whether we're their teacher or their parent. You get up in the morning, you come into the classroom, or, you know, you're getting ready to start your homeschool day. Our attitude really affects how that day is going to go. I mean, how many times have you ever, you know, a lot of us have homeschooled because we think back to our days when we did sit in a classroom and how boring it was. And we have to remember that homeschooling can be just as boring if we don't get excited about it. And it's our attitude and excitement about the different subjects and disciplines that are going to rub off on our children. What is your view of the child? What are you thinking? Are you waking up thinking, oh, I have another day. This is going to be hard. Johnny doesn't want to do his work. What's it going to take for me to get him to do it today? Or are you looking at it as a challenge that's exciting, that you're out to conquer this and you're in this together and it's going to be a great adventure? Listen to the feedback that you're getting from your own children and from the students in your class that you teach. What are they saying? What are the subjects that they gravitate towards? There's probably a reason they gravitate towards them. It's probably something that's rubbed off from you. My children always laugh because they say my face is always in a book. There are things they say about Marlon. They think he always has a golf club in his hand. And it's rubbed off on different children in different ways. And those things do. The things we're passionate about are the things that our children are passionate about. I love the Egyptian time period, ancient Egypt, and I love it because of something that happened to me as a child. I had a friend whose father was in the oil business, and he lived in Egypt for about the first 10 years of his life, and I used to love going over to his home and seeing all the artifacts and things that they had brought back, and it just really piqued my interest in that. And then as a young child, I started reading a lot about Egypt because I wanted to explore it more. You know, 40-some-odd years later, I still, if I have any time period in history to read about, will read about the Old Testament and about Egyptian history over any other time period that there is. My interest is still perked. Well, what is the grammar stage? There's a quote on here from Dorothy Sayers that says, "It's the stage is the one in which learning by heart is easy and on the whole pleasurable, whereas reasoning is difficult. And on the appearance of things, one likes to recite. One rejoices in the chanting of rhymes and rumble and thunder of unintelligible polysyllables. One enjoys the mere accumulation of things. Simply said, the grammar stage is the time to think of the child as a sponge that soaks up the information." My husband likes to refer it to as putting information on the hard drive, and he's right. You're just storing this wealth of information so that later on they can come back to it and glean from that as they do greater and more difficult works. When I'm evaluating grammar school curriculum, and I look at a whole lot of it every year, the one thing that I'm looking for, and I'd encourage you to do this no matter what curriculum you use, is it something that they can recite over and over again? Is it memorable? Can it be something that they can stick to? Poetry is one of those things that does that. Chanting does that. Music does that. Does whatever curriculum you're using have something that causes them to have something that they can hang on to and recite over and over and over again? I love narration. Narration is absolutely wonderful, but narration in and of itself is not going to put anything on the hard drive. When we first started, you have to excuse me, I have this cough that I've had for quite a few days here. When we first started out in looking at curriculum for our own children, one of the things that I, you know, looked at was a lot of historical fiction. And I love historical fiction. I think it's great. It brings things alive. But that is not ever anything, that is not something that a child is going to be able to hang his hat on later on. It's not something that as they go to read, say, Herodotus, my book that I keep referring to today, that they're going to get anything really to peg things on later on about the ancient Greeks. As they've read historical fiction about that time period, they might have found cultural facts and it might have spurred them on to look further, but it's not something that they can put over and over and over again in their mind. If you look in the back of your pack, you'll see it's a poem called Upper Egypt, Lower Egypt. Now, one of the cards that we have in our Old Testament Ancient Egypt series deals with this exact subject. And this is a poem we do at school. It comes out of a series called Ancient Rhymes from Ancient Times, Modern Rhymes from Ancient Times. And this is a great way to help children understand a difficult concept. Upper Egypt, Lower Egypt, yes, it is perplexing, because lower's up and upper's down, it's really very vexing. The River Nile flows south to north, for those of you just setting forth, so check the maps right in your books, down, river's up, or so it looks. And if you travel up the Nile, that's Upper Egypt, mile by mile, but on a map you're heading down, no wonder students wear a frown. Upper Egypt, Lower Egypt, some think it's amusing that lowers up and uppers down. To me, it's just confusing. We memorize that poem at school when we're trying to help children study geography and understand the whole idea of Upper and Lower Egypt and what Pharaoh Menes was trying to rule over and what he was trying to pull together. And those are the kind of tools that I look for to help put them in their memory. So then when I have a child who takes a test or does a worksheet and doesn't do well, what I say to them is, and this is using the tools, memorization unto itself is worthless. It's what you do with that memorization. And I think sometimes that's why classical Christian education and why those of us who have heard about memorization, if we look at our American educational system, we got away from memorization. And I think part of the reason we did is it became something, you know, old habits can become bad habits when you, you know, it's kind of like a liturgy. if you just do it and it becomes so rote, you forget about what you're doing. You know, your pastor constantly has to remind you why you're doing what you're doing. That's our nature. When you get into a routine, it becomes mundane. These tools of memorization are to teach something. And so that's what we do with this. So when I have a child that then gets the answer wrong, I'll say to them, remember that poem that we memorized? You think that Upper Egypt would be up here on the map. It's not. It's down here on the map. Tell me the poem. Let's think about it. Same thing with things like Shirley grammar jingles. A sentence, sentence, sentence is complete, complete, complete. When five simple rules, it meets, meets, meets. Okay, I could go on here, but when I circle something and tell a child that this is not a complete sentence, what I say to them is, tell me why it's not complete. I don't know, Mrs. Detweiler. Okay, let's go through your sentence jingle. Tell me what the five rules are. Okay, did it meet the first rule? Yes. Did it meet the second rule? Yes. Did it meet the third rule? No. Okay, let's go back. Take your paper back to your seat. Fix it to where it goes with the third rule. There's no point in memorizing these things if we're not doing something with it, okay? It's not something that you're doing just for the sake of doing it. Children do have to think, and that's what this is helping them to do. A couple other things to look at here would be, I think I have this in here, songs. There's something called Legends and Leagues. It's in the back of your binder. You know, this is to row, row, row your boat, round and round and round the globe, round and round run the globe, equator run, splitting up the hemispheres, now we're having fun. Same thing, we're memorizing, we're trying to teach them what a hemisphere is, we're trying to teach them how to divide up the globe, but we're doing it through a song to put it to memory. How many things do you remember? Everybody remembers eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Everybody remembers, I could go down the laundry list, and you remember it because it was something that you did over and over and over again. So when you're looking for tools, find something that they can memorize and do through different means. Every discipline has its own set of fundamental grammar rules, and you're going to have to decide for your child what you want them to learn. At Veritas Academy, we do not teach science. If you look at the Veritas Press catalog in grammar school, you will not find any science. We don't start science until seventh grade. The reason is historically, science as a discipline was not taught to young children until they had mastered the English language and learned some of the fundamentals of math. Because most of the sciences require you to have those kinds of understanding. By the way, our kids are doing just fine, not having had it until seventh grade. They hit the ground running and they do just fine. But every discipline that we do teach, but you may decide you want to teach your children science. So that was why I brought that up. You're not going to see that on our list, but every discipline has the grammar. For Bible, we're interested in having children memorize a timeline, basically working from Genesis all the way through Revelation, and they're memorizing the people, the places, the dates, so that they have that with them. Same with history. We picked those events, 36 events for each year that we thought were the most important for them to memorize. Are there other things they can memorize? Absolutely. There are only so many things you can, do. When you're memorizing these things, it's very important to remember that you've got to review them. If you study Old Testament, Ancient Egypt in second grade, and that's it, and then you get to sixth grade, and each year you've only studied one particular period of history a year, they will have forgotten it. That's why I said to you, it's got to be something that's repeatable. On a weekly basis at Veritas Academy, we review all of their history and Bible cards. We have a rotating cycle that we go through. We have something called memory period. It's the first 25 minutes of our day, and the children are doing all their chants for all the different disciplines that we study, and we rotate. On each of our history tests, if you look in our history manuals, you'll see that there's a place where you can choose to put three questions from prior history text. We always do that so that they're constantly working through a cycle of reviewing those questions. Latin, you know, there's so much to memorize there. All the paradigms and the vocabulary, and it's amazing what they can soak up if you start it and really stick to it at an early age. Math, we spend a lot of time memorizing addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and there's so many fun ways that you can do that, whether you're homeschooling or in a classroom. There's lots of fun games to play, flashcards, and there's just a lot of interesting things you can do with that. Obviously, teaching children to read, phonics, the fundamentals of their language, linguistics, teaching them to spell, there's spelling rules that you need to memorize. And I just encourage you to stick to whatever you choose. One of the things that I see happen is, you know, people go, oh, this is the hot thing this year, so we're going to go do this curriculum. And 2 years later, oh, my friend told me about this, and I'm going to do this. Well, by the time Johnny gets to sixth grade, he's had seven different curriculums, and they've just missed a whole lot of things in between. So find out what you think is good and try to stick with it. You know, we've talked about ways to doing it, chanting, singing, repetition, review. The other thing is writing. A lot of times in grammar school, we don't think as much about writing because it's, you know, it doesn't seem geared towards memorization, and it's not, but it's a very important and acquired skill. At the same time, I think in grammar school, we need to look at how children think when it comes to writing. And as a young child, all of us can remember going to class the first day, and what does your teacher ask you to do? Write about your summer vacation. Well, what about your summer vacation? You know, you sit there and you think, okay, I ought to be able to write about this, but you can't come up with anything. And one of the ways that children used to be taught to write was a modeling approach. That's why we like what Andrew Pudua has done with the Institute for Excellence in Writing. And he teaches children to outline a work and then kind of weans them out of the process to where they start writing their own work based on somebody else's work. It's a modeling approach. I tell people it's like giving you the answers before you begin. It gives you the charts and graphs. And so some people would say, well, that's not very creative. But what I've seen happen with children is that once they have the roadmap there, the creativity really comes about because they don't have to think about the structure. The other thing is your creativity. I am very much a hands-on person. I think that we need to bring things to life for children. If all we ever did was sit and memorize and read serious books, I don't think you're going to spark their interest. And I think that's part of what the reaction from our American educational system against memorization came from. We got once again into this very rote way of doing things, and we forgot that there was a lot of other things to do. I talk about being multisensory, the five learning gates, touch, taste, smell, sight, and hearing, and try to be creative. You know, look at in our history manuals and Bible manuals, we happen to have a lot of projects out there. There are lots of wonderful books that'll give you ideas. One of my children's favorite things to talk about is the horrible Egyptian meal that we had one night. We ended up, I think, having to go out that evening for dinner. It was so bad. But they will never forget that as long as they live. For most of them, it was a lot of years ago, at least 10, and it is still vividly in their memory. You know, what is it that your child likes to do? For some children, it's going to a museum. For other children, you know, it's an art project, or it might be music that captivates your child. What is it that's going to pique their interest? One of the things that I hear people say is, that's just not my thing. You know, my child really likes these projects, but I don't have time, and that's just not my thing. Unfortunately, as teachers, whether you're a teacher to your own child or somebody else's children, that's just not an answer you can give. It doesn't really matter if it's not your thing. If God's called you to teach, you know, it's not my thing to be organized, okay? Not my thing. My husband will be, you see him? He's grinning like a Cheshire cat. But Even though that's the case, I still have to keep my children's grades. If I'm in a classroom, I can't say to the principal, you know, it's just not my thing. I didn't get these grades done. They would look at me like, oh, yeah, right. You won't have a job next year. You've got to do some of the things that take you out of your comfort zone. The same time, I said to somebody earlier, as my children got earlier, that's what tutors are for, or school. There are certain things that I cannot teach. Failure to prepare, even in grammar school, I think it's critical. One of the things I really encourage parents to do that are homeschooling, our teachers at our school are actually required to do this at the beginning of the year, and that is to map out your entire year. How many times have you gotten to the end of the year and you go, oh my goodness, I'm on lesson 67. I've got 7 weeks left of school. I'm never going to make it. Or I only got halfway through my history. What happened? And one of the things that happens when you do long-term planning is not anybody who's teaches. One of the things that it does is it keeps you accountable. It keeps you on track so that I had two sick children this week. They were throwing up. I didn't get anything done. We missed our math lessons. What it says is the next week you're going to have to go longer in the day. Now you've got three math lessons you've got to, make up, because there's always something. You know, at our school, we don't generally make up snow days unless there's a huge accumulation of snow days. And so our teachers know if we have a snow day, that means the following week they've got to fit that extra material in, because we can't not cover it. Not covering the material is not an option. The other thing is just a lack of energy. I can remember, one of the common things at a school is, you hit April and everybody's just kind of, how am I going to make it through the rest of the school year? As a homeschooling mom, it was like, this is never going to end this year. You really get on to picking out your curriculum for next year, because that's fun, because you don't have the mundaneness to that. What do you do? It's that lack of energy. Find out things that are fun for you. When we lived in Florida, I'd go have school outside for the day. You got to stick to what you're doing, but it just breaks up the day. It makes it more interesting. I homeschooled with a friend, and we would go to the park and have our morning lessons or something to just make it a little bit different. Take a field trip, plan something that'll just break up your week for you. The thing that I think every one of us needs to remember is you really are making the memories that are going to last a lifetime for your child. You're putting all this information in, and so much of who they are as an adult depends on what you give them. Now, that's an awesome responsibility as a parent or a teacher to take, but that's the way it is. We're giving them what they are going to have for the rest of our lives, and that should really excite us to think what an opportunity it is. It can scare us or it can excite us, and I like to look at it as it's just an exciting opportunity to have. You're shaping the future adults of the next generation. But from what my husband talked about this morning, you've got to think about it this way. Not only are you shaping your children, what you give your children is potentially what your great-great-great-grandchildren are going to be given. This is a generational thing. And that is so important for us to remember as we try to recover this information. We're not doing it just for our children. There have been some disappointments as we look at the education that our children have. Our children have all, by the grace of God, found different things that they have loved. But when I look back, there are things that I see that I wish that I had been able to give them. Because of where we were, it wasn't there. Our oldest son will say, I wish that I had had more of this or more of that. And we always say to him, we wish you had too. In the life of where the school was at the time, we didn't have some of those things. And he's done quite well. I think my husband said he's in a PhD program in nanotechnology and, a six-year PhD. He's doing just fine. But there are things now that he knows that he wants to give his children. And that's what we say to him. That's great. Pick up the torch. It's your turn now. It's your turn now. And so look at this as a long-term thing. If you'll look in this packet, I'm just going to go over a couple different things. One of the other things is, particularly when you're homeschooling, but this is true in school, we would never, everybody says, how do you get it all done? I can't fit it into a day. The only way we get everything done is by integration. Otherwise, we couldn't. If I looked at everything as a separate discipline, I'm going to have English grammar, and I'm going to write about something for English grammar, and I'm going to have history, and I'm going to memorize all my cards, plus do my writing projects, we would never get it done. This happens to be, it's a history worksheet that they're doing off of their history card, which everybody should have some form of history card, but they're reviewing their grammar. And so Nigel Noun asks who and what. But anyway, they're going to do this off of their history card. And so they're going through the question-answer flow, getting the information off of their history card. So that means they're reviewing this, because they have to read it in order to do the sheet. So they're going to review their history card, but they're also going to have to be applying their English grammar. The next thing that you're going to see is called a time tripper board game. All that is a great thing. You know, how many times do you have a day where you feel like you need to do something different? And did anybody not get a packet? Because we have extras up here that we can get passed out. Can you get a packet? But this is a great way to help them memorize their history cards. It's just another technique for doing it. The next thing you'll see is something called resource notes person. There's one for person, one for events, a visual record, which means art. And once again, it's just another way to have them do their history cards, or look at a resource and give you the information back. We do a lot of dioramas at school. You'll see these little Egyptian figures in there. I think we also have some Greek ones and medieval. We use these a lot for literature books. I just finished judging at our school. We have something called Zeus's Family Reunion. And when we read Dale Ayer's book of Greek myths, each child picks a character, and they have to put a diorama together and write a paragraph and then dress up as the character, and we have Zeus's family reunion. It's a big thing at school every year. But so we're incorporating writing. We're incorporating the book that they read to put the diorama together. It's just a comprehension exercise. You know, did they get it? Did they understand what they were reading? You'll see in here some invitations. This is for the barbarian invasion. You know, if you're homeschooling, get a group of families together and do these kind of things. If you're a school, obviously you can just put these together for individual classrooms. The other thing you'll see in here, you can keep going through, there's postcards to have them be accountable for field trips. And then this is like an old maid game. It's from the history cards. It's to help them memorize. This one happens to be Old Testament, Ancient Egypt. And it's just to help them memorize their dates and their places. I'm for using any tool that works to help them memorize the material. Well, I'm going to open it up to questions now. Yes. Sure. Memory period is the first 25 minutes of our day. We have a list of all the, and let me say for those of you that are homeschoolers, this is a great thing to just keep ready in your bank to do in the car. But we have a list. So for us, it's Shirley Grammar Chants, Bible cards, history cards, linguistics rules, Latin, math, facts, and we have a rotating schedule. Oh, and catechism. Our children memorize the Westminster Shorter Catechism. And so we have every day we do every discipline, but it's on a rotating schedule for what's going through. So 1 week we'll be doing New Testament, Greece, and Rome. Actually, we do two-week time periods. And then the next week we'll switch to maybe medieval, and it switches. We spend 2 weeks, we do two Westminster Shorter Catechism questions with scripture memory. We're rotating through Andrew Pudua's The Phonetic Zoo, all those linguistics rules. We do two of those a week. We do two Latin chants. We do two math facts, and it's very, very quick. Somebody's asked me, well, how can you possibly get that done? The children know what we're doing, and there is no lag time. So it's just, you know, a mo, a mas, a ma, a mamas, a mats, a mont, bo, bis, bit, bimis, 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 bunt, a sentence is complete. I mean, it is just like, this is pure memorization, and it's fun, but it's really fast and furious is the way somebody described it that came in to see it. Yes. We use, they're in our catalog, and it is, help me with the lady's name, Kathy Troxell's math songs. They're in each of the grade levels. They're called, hold on, and I'll tell you here.
You might also want to talk about how it operates.
Oh, sure. It's the beginning of the day, but hold on. Helps when I can find alphabetical order here. It's called Math Memory Songs. Look at page 16. That's the division songs there. They're throughout all the grades, but they're called Math Memory Songs. So, other questions? Yes. What is special? There's really not anything special. We just happen to like find the tunes are really catchy, and so the children like to, you know, sing them. So, I mean, there are a lot of different things out there. We just happen to think these are the best ones. That's one of those things that I think you just have to commit to doing it. It's kind of like committing it to memory, and you just do them. It just happens to be the ones that we use at school and really like them. Yes. Yes.
They are really creative, and they want to write, mm-hmm. and you want to slow them down mm-hmm. and say, let's look at your dress-ups, and then
right.
they become frustrated.
Right.
How do you kind of get over that?
Do you use the checklist that's in there at all right. to have them do? I mean, I think just keeping them accountable to that. We actually tell them you have to have three dress-ups in this paragraph. You have to have... and so we have a list of things. You know, you have to have used so many L-Y words. You have to have... And then we have a checklist. The teacher makes up a checklist depending upon what she wants, and they have to physically go through and check it off. That when they get to the end, it's kind of part of the editing process.
You can let them go,
and then they have to go back in. And if they haven't done it, then they have to redo the paper. It doesn't take too many times of redoing the paper to where they go, okay, this would have been better if I'd just done this in the first place. So, other questions? Yes. Absolutely. 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 Yeah. Yeah. But that's why they need it more, because the girls really don't need it. But the other thing is, when you think kinesthetically, a lot of children learn by writing. And so particularly a lot of little boys learn that way. They just don't like to do it. Well, we actually do, when we get, after we get, what time do I have till?
2:20.
Okay. Okay. I'm looking at that clock going, it says 12:25. Something is seriously wrong. Okay. When we start, let me help everybody understand here. For those of you who don't know, the Veritas Press has a weekly worksheet and a weekly test that they then write all their timeline out that they've started. Once we get through the first six to ten cards, we separate their test day from their chronology day. And the reason is because it would take them an hour and a half otherwise. And so we do the test, we do Bible test on Wednesday, history test on Thursday, chronologies on Friday for history, chronologies on Tuesdays for Bible. And that's why. And it does take some of them a half an hour to write out their chronology. Well, and the thing that I found for children that really struggle and dawdle, we keep what I call old-fashioned egg timers, those hourglass things, and we stick them on their desk and say, you know, you got to get this done by the time that egg timer's done. And I don't know. There's something about that. They like it. I don't know. Competition, that's it. Particularly boys, competition. I have some teachers that use candy. I don't care. I don't care what they use. If it gets done and they've done it well, I don't care. Yes. Right. Yeah, it's tough, and that's why... And that's understandable. The question is, how do you get it all done, particularly having ages, different ages of children, different grades to teach, and a baby? You know, it's tough. That's part of why I said you've got to have long-term planning. And it's also looking, at what your family dynamics and your schedule are. Spending time, you know, I think younger children have got to get their reading and their math done in the morning when they're wide awake, because if you look at any kind of test results on anything like that, test scores plummet when children do those two disciplines, you know, after about 1 o'clock. It has to do with their attention span. And so I think juggling that, but finding things that they can do on your own, not trying to think of compartments by, I've got an hour for history and I'm going to teach them their history lesson. And then, you know, we're all going to do history, but thinking more like a one-room schoolhouse. And a one-room schoolhouse had some dynamics that were very interesting, which was you might teach your math lesson in the morning, but they aren't going to do the math lesson until, say, 10 o'clock. You might teach it at 8 o'clock in the morning. Child's not actually going to do it till 10 o'clock in the morning, because you're going to bring everybody back to history. But then when they go do their actual written math work, now you've got time to sit and work with that older child while the other child's occupied. And you're going to have to work it around a nap schedule. You're going to have to know when your baby naps so that you can get your teaching time in during that. Now, as they get older, a lot of people, you know, I've seen a lot of 3- and 4-year-olds that had their little school stuff and they could only touch it during that time period, you know. And they had a basket they brought out and they might get 20 minutes out of that. I have other friends who actually have hired babysitters, you know, or had older women at their church that were willing to come in 2 mornings a week and just watch the baby for them, just, you know. And so it's just trying to figure that out. It's not going to be forever that you have a baby. So it's complicated is the short of it. Or find a friend to share. I mean, find a friend who homeschools that you can trade off with. That's what we did. I taught history. I taught all the liberal art type stuff. And she taught all the math, grammar, Latin. And I would teach in the morning, and she would teach in the afternoon. And I taught her 2 children, and she taught my 3 children at the time. But we were very compatible, and we thought alike. So, and that worked out great. She had a baby at the time. I had a 3-year-old at the time. And it worked out great, because whoever wasn't teaching had the little ones. Yes. That's a great idea. That's a great idea.
But my question for you is, would there be a kind of a list of what to review
Sure. I'll see if Veritas Press can work on that. I said I'd see. Yes.
You were talking about planning a whole year out. Mm-hmm. Do you have a chart that you suggest, or are you talking about going through each book and reading the whole book through and just, you know, making a weekly schedule for the whole year, or what? How are you?
Yeah, basically, I mean, you however many weeks of school you're going to cover. Actually, you know what? I'm going to let the expert come up here.
Could you go by the history cards and divide?
You can. You can, but he's really good. He teaches our teachers how to do this. So.
You're talking about every discipline. Yeah, and let's take an easy. If you use Saxon math, for example, there are a number of lessons in a book. Well, it depends on the book, in the grammar school books. But what we do, and if one of the difficulties in homeschooling is after you've done a book, you're onto another book. You're always a first-year teacher if you only have one student, and that's a lot of work. Any teacher will tell you the first year is hell. It's a tough year, and that's what you're dealing with. But what we do is we literally line it out. We've got, say, 36 weeks, and we may not even have 5 days a week. What are you going to do with tests? What are you going to do with holidays? What are you going to do with those kinds of things? So we have what we call a curriculum map that's a pretty long sheet of paper and has it all blocked out on a weekly basis. And then we mark it off. And included in all that, so now we've planned it. But one of the problems with long-term planning is a failure to plan for the unplanned. Okay? Snow days, sickness, opportunities not anticipated. You know, grandma's going to be in town. you know, it could be anything. And so one of the things is to put in a fudge factor for that. The other thing is to put, you've planned it all out, but now what you want to do is mark off certain points of certain times when you're going to check how you're doing. Those people that do plan many times fail because after they plan, they throw it in a file drawer. And a plan is to be referred to from time to time. So that's an important part of it also. And in the math, taking Saxon as an example, it's pretty easy to do. Now, there's another aspect, and this is true of Saxon. It's not true of every math curriculum. But Maxon has an enormous amount of repetition and review. That's the nature of it. 3 steps forward, 2 steps back, keep on going, that sort of thing. Well, if you have a student who gets a concept exceptionally well, and that's the only one you're teaching, you might be able to consolidate some lessons. That's an opportunity. That takes a little bit of familiarity with the book, a little bit of familiarity with the concepts, but you look for places you can consolidate. In other words, you're looking for opportunities to customize to your circumstance. And that's a very important part of it. Now, we've tried to organize the history and literature, excuse me, the history and Bible this way. She said 36 cards and didn't mean that. It's actually 32 cards. But we tend to think of a school year as 36 weeks, 4 9-week quarters. Where did we get that? It's from our experience, so that's what we did. There's nothing magic about it. But it's been fairly typical. And we have 32 cards so that there's an additional week each quarter for repetition and review, for testing, and for catch-up. So we've lived by our own words of putting a cushion in there. There are other things that are a little bit more difficult. What about literature? That's a little tougher. But those are the kinds of things that you need to map out. You need maybe talk to somebody else that's worked with those books. How long did it take you to cover this book? What did you do? And that sort of thing. Okay, she probably has more experience with that one than I do. And it's a matter of doing all of them, but it's important to keep evaluating along the way so that you can make your adjustments. If I lose 3 days in the first week of school, I can probably figure out how to make those up. But if I lose 3 days with 2 weeks to go, that's a lot harder. And what you don't want to find out is that you have 4 weeks worth of work done, 4 weeks worth of work with 2 weeks left. And you don't want to be caught by surprise. I was, in the early years of Veritas Academy, I got lassoed into teaching two maths in one period in Saxon, and it was upper grammar school. The math itself was the easy part. I didn't have to open the book before starting. It was just a matter of going right to the lesson and being able to do that. But I had to think through, how was I going to do that? Well, I taught the one class the lesson, and then they went and did their work, and then I taught the other class the lesson for the next day, having had them in the early part of that working on the lesson from the previous day. So it just worked in sequence. Worked out perfectly. It was easy to do. But then we had some snow days. Then we had some field trips. Now I had to factor all that in. And I literally designed a little Excel spreadsheet to make it so I could see where I was the whole time and so I could constantly update it. Now that's getting a little anal and taking it a little far, but it worked and it helped me not lose track and be able to finish. Because the one thing that we're concerned about is that we finish what we start every year. Because we've got to be able to take the student and hand them off to the next teacher, having completed what we promised we would complete, both to the parents, to the curriculum, and, of course, to the teacher in the following year.
A practical thing, just two quick things here that I do when I plan is chapter books, so anything that's a chapter book. When I'm planning out, so this is history. This is card 1, 2, 3, 4. We pretty much plan 6 cards, then give a week's break, just because that is a good, when I say a week's break, we don't necessarily take the break, but it's doing what he said, planning for oops. But then I see here I'm supposed to be doing card number 3. Well, I go look, and you can do this too. If you've ever looked at a Veritas press catalog, we tell you historical fiction, which card they go with. So now what I do to make sure that I've got my historical fiction matched up with my cards is I go plot that in for a week. Well, as you get into the elder grades, third and above, most of the books are going to take more than 1 week. I generally figure a chapter a day. Okay, that's what I generally figure. So I've got 15 chapters in the book. I've got 3 weeks that I've got to plot that books for. So now, you know, let's say we're reading Terza, whatever. So that's, say it's not, but say it was week number 5. Now I know that I've got to plot that out for 3 weeks there. So I can't start another literature book until that's done. Okay? I have time for one last question, I think, if there is one. Yes. I don't, but go ahead.
As far as writing, I teach first and have taught second grade.
Okay.
AW, you know, is more second grade.
Absolutely.
What do you recommend, like writing strands?
For writing, we use the Shirley Grammar in first grade.
We do have that too. But
so, I'll tell you, there's another, hold on here, and I can tell you. Well, there's another thing in first grade that if I can look here real quick and find it, I'll tell you. If not, I'll talk to you afterwards. Okay. On page 12, it's called Writing Skills Workbook, Paragraph Writing, and Write a Super Sentence. Those are excellent for first graders. We use those all the time at school. Okay, if you see these nifty little stickers here, if you look under your chair, at least I think that's where he put them. Y'all probably have to literally get up and turn the chair over is my guess. They're right there. If you have one of these nifty little stickers under your seat, has anybody found one yet? You did. Okay, is it under the chair?
Yeah, it's a butterfly.
It's a butterfly under the chair. If so, you may come up here and get a, if you have one of those under your seat, you may come get a book out of the box. Thank you.